This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, Palestine reels from the killings of two Palestinian teens by Israeli forces on May 15th, when Palestinians marked the 1948 Nakba catastrophe. Also, we speak with Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey, days after the Israeli High Court heard their appeal of the wrongful death case on behalf of their daughter, who was run over by an Israeli soldier operating a bulldozer in Gaza in 2003.
Most immediately, there was some relief because it's another hurdle. And there have been so many of them as this has gone on year after year after year.
Plus, Andrew Dalek, co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild's Palestine Subcommittee, with his impressions on the court proceedings. In a significant victory, DePaul University students pass a divestment bill by referendum. Hannah El-Sheikh of DePaul Students for Justice in Palestine talks about the efforts by outside political groups and the Israeli government to try and stop it. And a report by Nader Ihmoud in Chicago on the Betunia Soccer Club and its role in the Palestinian-American community. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland, with Nader Ihmoud in Chicago. First, we go to the West Bank. Closed-circuit television cameras captured the Israeli army's killing of two teenage boys during a protest near the Ofer military prison in the occupied West Bank village of Betunia on May 15th, on Nakba Day, when Palestinians commemorate and protest the expulsion of more than 750,000 Palestinians and the destruction of hundreds of villages leading up to and after the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. 17-year-old Nadim Siam Nuwara and 16-year-old Mohammed Mahmoud Oda Abu Al-Tahir were gunned down by live ammunition fired by Israeli soldiers. The original videos were released by Defense for Children International Palestine Office last week. Meanwhile, Haaretz reported that Israeli military sources are claiming that, quote, the shots may have been fired by the Palestinian side rather than by Israeli troops. And senior Israeli officials said a video of the shootings that has sparked an outcry was likely forged. However, new video emerged last week from CNN, whose cameras were trained on the Israeli occupation soldiers who shot one of the boys and captured the moment that the live ammunition was fired. In addition to the two teens who were killed about an hour apart, two more Palestinians, one aged 15 and one in his 20s, were injured by live fire at the same location that day. Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has said it has, quote, obtained medical opinions regarding the entry and exit wounds found in the bodies of all four victims, which are completely consistent with injuries caused by live fire and could not have been caused by rubber-coated metal bullets, especially not when fired at a relatively long range, as was the case here. The evidence, B'Tselem says, raised, quote, grave suspicion that occupation forces, quote, willfully killed two Palestinians and injured two others, and demanded investigation by Israel's military police investigations unit, quote, into the military's highly incorrect version of the incident conveyed to the media. Rifat Kassis, executive director of Defense for Children International Palestine, which released the original video of the killings, said, quote, rather than cast doubt on the video or lay blame on unknown Palestinian gunmen, Israeli authorities should conduct an impartial and transparent investigation into the killings that occurred on May 15th and hold the perpetrators accountable. Kassis added, quote, Mohammed Azza, the third teen shot with live ammunition on May 15th, told Defense for Children International's Palestine office in a sworn affidavit that he recalls Israeli soldiers filming or photographing the clashes. Israeli forces should release any footage they may have captured to the public as part of an impartial and transparent investigation. The U.S. government reaffirmed its, quote, deep respect for the Israeli army's moral code days after the video emerged of the cold-blooded sniper killings of the two Palestinian boys. For more of our in-depth coverage on the killings of Nadim Nuwara and Mohammed Al-Tahir, go to electronicintifada.net. We continue our coverage of the appeal in the civil suit against the State of Israel for the wrongful death of American peace activist Rachel Corey. Last week, the Corey family, Rachel's parents Cindy and Craig, and her sister Sarah, along with a packed courtroom of supporters, had their appeal heard at the Israeli High Court. It may take up to a year for the judges to return their decision. In a press release issued earlier last week, a number of U.S. and Palestinian human rights and civil rights groups, including the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, Al-Haq, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, stated, quote, 11 years after Rachel was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer, the Khoury family still awaits accountability from both the Israeli and U.S. governments. In that time, more human rights defenders, including U.S. citizens, have been killed and seriously injured by Israeli forces while standing in solidarity with Palestinians, just as Rachel was when she was killed trying to prevent the demolition of Palestinian homes in Gaza. Yet neither the Israeli nor the U.S. government has acted to prevent or redress these human rights violations. Cindy and Craig Khoury, Rachel Khoury's parents, spoke to us from Jerusalem. I asked them to talk about their impressions of what went on in court during last week's appeal.
I think most immediately there was some relief because it's another hurdle. And there have been so many of them as this has gone on year after year after year. So it just felt good, I think, that for our family, we knew that we would get to the other side of this. And then once again, we had taken the next step and done what we could do. It was a beautiful day here in Jerusalem. We'd been in the court once before in that building to visit it, but it's a stunning space. And I'm surprised both times that we were there. I guess it's because this is the Supreme Court. There weren't nearly as many people in the building as in the district court, where there's a lot more activity, I think, going on. But all the people that were there had come to support us. So it was, once again, just very moving and comforting and so reassuring to be surrounded by people in that courtroom, which was packed, who came in solidarity. And Jewish Israeli activist, the five members of the National Lawyers Guild who were in the region, Palestinian activists and attorneys, representatives of NGOs. So I think, you know, at least we personally, regardless of what the court reads into that, we personally felt the support, and that meant a lot. Media were there. So, there wasn't a big decision to come out of this day. So we were pleased that there was interest from the local media and from some of the international media in what was happening there. Initially, you know, it started actually with an exchange between the judge, the three judges. The fact that there were three judges was positive. Very early on, they extended condolences to our family, which was more respectful, I think, and appreciated. We were very appreciative of that. It seemed more respectful than what had happened at the district court. When we heard the discourse between the state's attorney initially and also with the justices, that first part was dealing with what is actually a side issue, but it's still an issue, which has to do with the autopsy that was done in Rachel's case, because our wishes, our family's wishes, were not followed. And also, contrary to what the state has said about that, we did not find out, our family didn't find out that our wishes hadn't been followed, because in the military police report that we were able to read, and in the summary part that they actually did release publicly, they stated that they had had a representative from the American Embassy present. And we found out through FOIA information later, some years after, that had not been the case. So there are some issues related to that. But it was kind of encouraging to be able to detect, even though we were listening to the Hebrew, that the justices were pushing pretty hard on the state's attorney in regard to whether that should be reviewed more by the lower court. And then when Hussein was questioned, it was a little hard because it seemed like they were challenging him quite a bit too, Hussein Abu Hussein, our attorney. But then we saw that they asked the same kinds of probing questions of the state's attorneys with the issues that are most important, I think, here that have to do with international law. So that's my reaction. It was short, 2 to 3 hours, 2.5 hours, I think. It seemed like it ended kind of abruptly. It's something of a relief that now what we do is wait.
And Craig, just a few moments of your reaction.
Well, I think beforehand, I felt really sort of at peace. I think the last day or something. For one thing, the night before, Cindy and I and Sarah attended a Hebrew performance of My Name is Rachel Corey down in Jaffa. And that was to a packed house and a wonderful actress who got 3 curtain calls, or maybe 4, I've forgotten now. And so that was kind of overwhelming to us. I mean, you just felt surrounded by warm people. So the other thing that went through my mind, I just felt like we've done what we could do. We have the best legal representation I think you could assemble for this, and they become dear friends over the years. We've all grown together, and so I knew that Hussein Abu Hussein would do his best, and that would be as good as any attorney could do. I thought, felt like we come prepared, and so I gave up the rest of it, because you can only control what you can do. And so I'm not responsible for what the court does or whatever. We bring the best case we can to the court. We ask the court to give justice. And we manage with some friends to get enough media there so that I think if there's no justice, then we can get media attention to it. And that's really all we can do. So I felt good about it. One of the people that Cindy, I don't think, mentioned that was there was the embassy, U.S. Embassy sent 2 people there. And so the Consul General led that group. And he actually sat down right next to Sarah in the beginning. And he was very clearly there and in front of the media. So I felt like the embassy also had our back, and I'm grateful for that, you know, and we appreciate that. So we did our best.
Cindy and Craig Corey, thank you so much for all you do and for being with us again on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Nora.
Representatives of Palestinian and international human rights and civil rights organizations were present in the courtroom during the appeal of the case of Rachel Corey. Andrew Dalek, co-chair of the Palestine Subcommittee of the National Lawyers Guild, was in attendance as part of a National Lawyers Guild fact-finding delegation to Palestine. I spoke to him from the occupied West Bank on Thursday and asked him to analyze what went on in the courtroom and if there was any indication of where this case was going.
I think, first of all, it's important to note that the strategy that the defense, the attorneys who were defending the army in this case, are using is, you know, it's based in the same kind of a philosophy that the Israeli army uses to dehumanize Palestinians in order to make murdering Palestinians and destroying Palestinian homes palatable, not only to the Israeli public, but, you know, to the rest of the world. So, for example, where the Israeli army will say that they have to bulldoze Palestinian homes because they're bulldozing the homes of terrorists, or they have to extrajudicially kill and maim Palestinians because they are killing terrorists. Well, they will, you know, typically substitute the word Palestinian for the word terrorist. They were doing the same thing when it came to Rachel Corey. And over and over again, the attorney for the defense for the Israeli military said that this was a military operation and Rachel Corey shouldn't have been there. It was almost as if to say that, you know, by attending and protesting the demolition of Palestinian homes at Rafah, Rachel Corey got what was coming to her. That's what the message, that's what the Israeli military's message was, and it was something that they repeated consistently throughout the hearing. Now, it was sort of difficult for us to tell sort of the direction, you know, how the judges felt. To be honest, the translation that we had from Hebrew to English was a bit spotty at times. But at first, the defense attempted to claim that the plaintiff's attorneys, in this case, the attorneys for Rachel Corey's estate and Rachel Corey's family, you know, failed to follow some basic procedural rules and include all of the claims. So they, you know, they made the kind of, you know, procedural arguments that, you know, we would expect from sort of, you know, smarmy defense attorneys, and, you know, to be perfectly honest. But the main question really revolved around, as far as we were concerned, is the Supreme Court going to recognize that the Army was negligent in failing to halt its military home demolitions when it realized that there were civilians who were not going to leave the zone? And the implications of this, from our perspective, are pretty severe. The Israeli military over and over, the defense attorneys for the Israeli military said over and over again that this is going to set a dangerous precedent if the Israeli Supreme Court rules in the Corey's favor, to the extent that it will show the international community that Israeli military operations can be interrupted and halted by interference, by civilian interference, by foreign civilian interference, and that this was an inappropriate precedent to set.
Andrew, can you talk a little bit more about that, about, you know, how significant this case is with that sort of precedent in mind? Of course, you know, at the same time this week, you know, 15-year-old Mohammed Abu Taher and 17-year-old Nadim Nuwara were killed with live ammunition during a Nakba Day protest. Can you talk about the mood on the ground and more on the kind of precedent that forcing Israel to comply with international law, including the extrajudicial assassination of civilians, could set if this case is overturned?
Well, you know, first of all, the mood on the ground is pretty somber, and there have been protests throughout the week since the murder of Nadim and Mohammed by the Israeli Defense Forces. And, you know, as I'm sure you've seen, and as have thousands, if not millions of others, the video that was captured by a security camera located in Betunia near the Afar prison where the protest was taking place, where the two teenagers were killed. That video clearly shows that at the time when the Israeli military shot in cold blood Mohammed and Nadim, that they did so when neither of the boys were even engaged in any sort of protest activities. They were simply walking around at the time when they were shot in the chest and murdered in cold blood. So what's clear is that the Israeli military is pursuing the same kind of agenda that it's pursued pretty much, you know, since even before Israel's, you know, founding and so-called independence in 1948, which is that it's going to do everything in its power to dehumanize the Palestinians, because by dehumanizing the Palestinians, it makes killing Palestinians, whether or not they're engaged in any sort of resistance activities, justified. It's the same kind of rhetoric that we hear coming out of the United States at times when it comes to the extraordinary rendition of individuals in detention centers overseas, or the placing individuals arbitrarily in indefinite arbitrary detention in Guantanamo Bay. That these kinds of actions are justified because these people are terrorists. Well, the Israeli military is saying the same thing about Nadim and Mohammed, and they said the same thing essentially about Rachel Corey, is that she was effectively a terrorist because she was trying to prevent the Israeli military from demolishing Palestinian homes in Rafah. So the implications of this are pretty significant. You know, if the Israeli Supreme Court can really rise to the occasion and do what is just, and not just, but in the abstract, but also in compliance with international law, and recognize that when the Israeli military continue to demolish Palestinian homes in Rafah and bulldozed Rachel Corey to death, that they did so under the belief that Rachel Corey's life did not matter anymore because she was standing up for Palestinians. And if the Israeli Supreme Court is willing to recognize that, and to be willing to recognize that not only was this behavior wrong, but that it was criminally negligent, I think that would be a very significant and important turning point, because it would show that at least one sector of Israeli society is no longer willing to accept the sort of rhetoric that comes out of the Israeli military that says that people who stand up for Palestinians and Palestinian rights are terrorists and shouldn't be considered human, and that Palestinians themselves are terrorists and shouldn't be considered human. So we hope that the Israeli Supreme Court rises to the occasion and recognizes that when the IDF bulldozed Rachel Corrie to death, that that they were wrong, and that her family should be compensated accordingly, and that the Israeli military should be held accountable.
Andrew, finally, was there any indication that you could see from your legal perspective that the three-judge panel at the High Court were in any way sympathetic to Rachel Corrie's family and their side of this issue?
You know, it was sort of hard to tell, to be honest. The judges at one point expressed their condolences to the Corrie family. It was unclear, to me at least, whether or not that expression of sympathy was meaningful or real, or if it was just sort of, paying lip service for the media. But at the same time, the judges did ask the defense attorney for the Israeli military some pretty tough questions, particularly given the fact that it was clear that this, you know, even buying into the rhetoric from the Israeli military that this was a quote-unquote necessary military operation, the fact that many of the homes that were set for demolition that day weren't fully demolished until months after Rachel Corrie's death really cast a lot of serious doubt on its own argument, the idea that this was a necessary military operation that Rachel Corrie was getting in the way of, and that she sort of assumed the risk and therefore her family shouldn't be compensated and the Israeli military shouldn't be held accountable. So there was some indication that the judges were really pressing the Israeli military on this question. And the issue is really going to come down to whether or not the Israeli Supreme Court is going to buy into the idea that not only was this military operation necessary, but that Rachel Corrie's presence there represented such a security risk that her death, was something that she should have expected, that she sort of assumed the risk in being there, and that her life, simply matters less because she was trying to interfere with the military operation. Again, I really want to reiterate that one of the main pervasive themes that the Israeli military's attorney said over and over again was that this is war, and we need to do things in times of war, and we can't let civilians get in the way of carrying out our objectives and our goals during war, which is obviously preposterous. It's a bunch of nonsense, but it's the same kind of rhetoric that the Israeli military has been using to justify the killing and murder, the murdering of Palestinians for decades. It's the same kind of justification that they've used to justify the murders of Muhammad and Nadim, and now in a sort of reckless shamelessness, the Israeli military is saying that the security videos that capture the extrajudicial assassinations of the two teenage boys are fakes. And this just shows you how low the Israeli military is willing to go to justify its murderous actions. And that was something that was really clear to everybody that was in the room at the Israeli Supreme Court. And I want to say that the courtroom was packed. There were over 100 people present. There was media from all over the world that was there. The Corries themselves, Rachel Corrie's parents and her sister were present. It was a really strong showing in support of Rachel Corrie. It was a really strong showing in support of justice. And ultimately, the National Lawyers Guild hopes that the Israeli Supreme Court will rise to the occasion and will hold the army accountable for Rachel Corrie's death in the way that international law demands.
All right, well, we're going to leave it right there, but of course we'll keep updated on this story. That's the voice of Andrew Dalek. He's the co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild Palestine Subcommittee and also a member of the current delegation touring Palestine this week. Andrew, thank you so much for being there and for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks, Noah. I really appreciate it.
We now turn to Chicago, Illinois. Students for Justice in Palestine at DePaul University led a campaign in support of a divestment referendum aiming to pull the university's investments from companies that profit from Israel's violations of human rights. After a week of sit-ins, rallies, outreach, sustained canvassing across campus, and other creative direct actions, it was announced on Friday afternoon that the student body referendum passed 54-46%. This means that next year's student body government will be bound against passing any bill that contradicts the outcome of this pro-divestment vote. Joining us on Friday to talk about the campaign was Hannah El-Sheikh of SJP at DePaul. I interviewed her just hours before the vote passed. I asked her to talk about the divestment referendum and what DePaul's Students for Justice in Palestine have been doing on campus all week as part of the campaign.
So the campaign has been ongoing for 2 months. We launched March 31st, which is the first day of our spring quarter. But in the last week, aside from canvassing and trying to engage in one-on-one conversations with students at DePaul throughout the week, we staged a sit-in on Tuesday, like you mentioned, where we took over a public seating area at DePaul University and the SNET Academic Center, which is a large gathering place. We hosted a sit-in, which actually draws upon the legacy of the Black Student Union at DePaul in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement. They staged a sit-in addressing the systematic racism within DePaul's administration. And so what we did is we had teach-in, supportive professors taught their classes there. We had workshops that ranged from Palestine 101 to DEFCA to teach-ins about mass incarceration. So it really was themed around social justice and was a really interesting moment. And then on Wednesday, we dropped a flag, a 70-foot Palestinian flag in the largest academic building on our campus during the passing period, in which we all chanted, "Vote yes to divest." And we really grabbed the attention of the student body at that time. And then we rallied around campus, draw everyone's attention. And then yesterday, while the Israeli Consul General watched along, he was right there, we had a DEFCA flash mob, and people all stopped to watch us and really enjoyed seeing that and celebrating Palestinian culture and realizing that despite efforts to dehumanize us by groups like Stand With Us and the Opposition, that, you know, Palestinians are humans who have a culture and that's being erased. So it really helped people identify with us and empathize with us in that way. So it was really interesting. It was also interesting to notice that most of the people that were lobbying against us were not, in fact, affiliated with the university. They were either Stand With Us employees or university students from other schools being paid by Stand With Us to come and flyer at our school and spread misinformation about the campaign. The Israeli Consul General claimed that this was not something that was threatening to him, whether or not to Paul. Past divestment, but spent his entire day on our campus policing us and watching us and lobbying students at our school. So it was very interesting to see that.
If you could actually talk a little bit more about the response by SJP and human rights advocates on campus to the overwhelming amount of anti-Palestinian groups and outside political organizations and even the Israeli Consul General himself who have descended on DePaul to try and thwart the referendum from passing.
So what we've been doing, first of all, we addressed some misinformation that was spread about our campaign, because the first effort of this group was to spread some false rumors about us. They claimed that we were anti-Semitic. They claimed that this effort was actually a front for trying to get the funding to Jewish Life cut. And I mean, we were shocked to hear this happening and responded immediately to that. Myself and another member of the group authored an article, an op-ed in our school newspaper, where we addressed all of these claims directly. And when they can no longer make these claims because we publicly addressed them, their new tactic was masquerading as pro-Palestine. They had pro-Palestine written on their shirts, so their aim was to confuse other students at the school and tell them, "We're pro-Palestine, so vote no." So people thought they were voting in favor of divestment by voting no on our bill. So that was something we would do. So our best effort was just to campaign as aggressively as we could and be everywhere on campus. And at this point, many people rallied around us and supported us. I mean, we had 16-member coalition involved. So we really have a lot to thank. We have a lot of people to thank for helping us there with canvassing. And then our best effort was just staying nearby. There are many points where I would hear somebody who was not affiliated with the university telling a DePaul student they want to pull funds from a company like Intel, who is an innovator in the field. And then we say, well, that's actually not on our list. It's not on the list of companies we're targeting. This person doesn't know what's on our list of target companies because he's not affiliated with the university, in which case a lot of the times I was either yelled at or another Stand With Us representative would take a photograph of me in an effort to intimidate me. So the best you could do is just be as proactive as possible and continue. There's 25,000 students at the school. So rather than engaging a lot of the time, sometimes we would just have to focus on speaking to more and more students at the school to get them to vote yes.
Well, finally, Hannah El-Sheikh, how can people support DePaul SJP and this divestment campaign going forward?
Moving forward, I would say we're going to approach the Fair Business Practices Committee at DePaul. So we're going to continue working towards divestment. So any sort of support in that way, letters to pressure the administration to adopt this would be very helpful for us. We also have a group started by DePaul alums, DePaul Alumni Against Israeli Apartheid, that people can get in touch with if you're affiliated with DePaul. We also have a GoFundMe. So a lot of the times we have a lot of problems with the administration in terms of funding, but that would be a nice way to help us so that we don't lose our momentum in the upcoming school year, because this is really only the beginning of divestment. So we have a lot of work to do going forward. So any contributions, large or small, would also be very helpful to us as well. Our website is www.dpudivest.org. So that's with an S, divest.org.
Great. Hannah El-Sheikh, you're with Students for Justice in Palestine at DePaul University in Chicago. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And again, that divestment referendum at DePaul University did indeed pass on Friday afternoon. And finally, our contributor Nader Ihmoud, also in Chicago, has this report.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians live in the Chicagoland area, and the Petunia Soccer Club wants to be a reason they can all come together. The club manager, Adnan Safi, says the team is one of a few made up of mostly Palestinian Americans in the Chicagoland area. It is the most popular and talented among them, he says. The team is named after the Palestinian village because its head coach, Sami Mehdi, was born there. However, the club does have players from different backgrounds, such as Saudi Arabia and Mexico. In an attempt to gain more fans and bring the Palestinian community together, Safi, an immigrant from Elid, invited Arab Idol winner Muhammad Asaf to an exhibition match held at the Bridgeview Sports Dome May 15th, the 66th anniversary of the Nakba. Safi says the game was held as a celebration of the reconciliation of Hamas and Fatah and was only played on that date because of a scheduling conflict with Asaf.
We decide to make it as big as we can, you know, just calling a famous an artist guy, a singer, Muhammad Asaf. He's the winner of Arab Idol, and we have decided to make it good for the community, and was for free charge, make everybody just play and just get more active with the sport.
Asaf showed up an hour after the 9 p.m. match was supposed to begin. The 2013 Arab Idol winner shook hands with the Petunia Club and waved at the large crowds of men and women who were chanting his name. Those in attendance for the exhibition were there mostly to see Asaf. But this wasn't the first time the Petunia Club played in front of a large audience, says Mustafa Akalagazi, an immigrant from Yafa.
If you come here on the final game, you see a whole crowd of people here.
Safi and other members of the Petunia Club acknowledge that giving the community an incentive to show up to games is a way to get them to show up more often.
For you, when you have a famous guy come to a sport or a soccer game, this community will active with you more. You know, for us to be to go stand more and move steps up, we have to bring more famous peoples.
The Petunia Club is joining a league in June, the Chicago World Cup, under the name Palestine. Ihsan Ali, whose parents are immigrants from Turmus Aya, says the club's significance exceeds winning and losing.
It's pretty important because it really gathers everyone in our community. All the Arab in the community, we all play together here, and it really brings us together.
Akolagasi says matches like these help keep the Palestinian culture intact using sports.
It's continuing our culture, and especially in in the United States, it's not our country. Basically, you know, most of the players here are immigrants too. They came from overseas recently, you know. So it's like we continue our culture here.
For the Electronic Intifada in Chicago, I'm Nader.
And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.